This edition of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 18th of September, on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on this week's show, we visit a pioneering young design studio in Ramallah making treasure out of trash.
When it comes to trash that we know already is a huge problem, that's what we start out by designing, and then we finding the raw material has been the easiest part.
We then take in the aisles of the Fustockists Craft Trade Fair in Tokyo, a veritable treasure trove of new names, keeping old skills alive.
We're looking to showcase some of the best Japanese craftsmen's work.
And as the global fashion crowd trots into London, we take our pew on the front row at one of the city's most exciting young talents, Christopher Raeburn.
Each season we do a different remade story, and by that I mean it's part of our collection where we're deconstructing and reworking original military garments or different items.
More of that in a little bit. Plus, we find out who'll be getting their hands on all the furniture from the now vacant Olympic site in London. I sit down with Hong Kong architect Andre Fu to hear about a very high swimming pool. And over in New York, we drop in on a dusty Soho garage where Italian brand Benetton has set up shop. That's all to come over the next hour here on Section D. The Middle East is not the first place you'd think of for pioneering green design, but things are changing, even in the most unlikely of places. Shams Ard, which means Sun Earth in English, is a new design studio in the de facto West Bank capital of Ramallah. It's busy creating furniture and buildings entirely from reclaimed waste materials. Partly a response to the excesses of the recent building boom in Ramallah, the studio's helping Palestinians regain a sense of autonomy through green thinking and community empowerment, as Monocle's Joseph Dana found out.
In a small studio, perched on a rugged hillside amidst Ramallah's jumbled architecture, a group of four young architects, two women and two men, are quietly bringing green design thinking to Palestine.
We started discussing together what we can do, like some green design. We want to start with like street furniture design in Ramallah.
Gath Nasser is one of the members of Shams Ard Design Collective in Ramallah.
And then we decided to open a studio together and work on green design in general, including furniture, street furniture, architecture, interior design, landscaping, and all of that stuff, because we felt that this was something that was lacking in Palestine with all the building that's happening and all the construction. No one's really looking at our responsibility as designers towards the environment and towards our local society as well.
Shams Ard means sun and land in Arabic. The designers came together earlier this year with the shared goal of using alternative materials and design solutions that highlighted social and environmental responsibility. Frustrated with the status quo, both in Palestine's insular design world and on the political front, the designers set about on their first project, a furniture line made from local material and reclaimed waste. Shams Ard designer Dana Massad explains the creation process.
Waste is all around us, like trash is all around us. And so we know that there are a lot of tires thrown out. We know that plastic bags people don't know what to do with. And so when it comes to trash that we know already is a huge problem, that's what we start out by designing, and then finding the raw material has been the easiest part. And what we found very interesting is that people, once they found out about us, and this was before even the exhibition, just by word of mouth, they started bringing their trash out here because they really don't want to throw it away, but they don't know what else to do with it. And so we'd find, you know, a pile of trash, you know, of things, like for us, they are very valuable things that are right outside of our office, you know, at times when we come to our office, which the landlord was not very happy about.
In June, Shams Ard celebrated their first exhibition. Experiment number one showcased 42 furniture and lighting pieces sourced entirely from local waste material, like old doors, paper tubes, a metal drum, tires, and water pipes. From simple lighting fixtures designed out of discarded metal collected in Ramallah's industrial park, to a table made out of a door found in front of the studio, the exhibition showcased the studio's ability to create functional items from the most unconventional materials. Ramallah loved it, to the surprise of the designers. Lina Saleh explains.
People before the exhibition, like our friends, our families, didn't take us that serious. They said, you're engineers, you have to focus on what's going on. So when they came and they saw the product, some fun stuff, some others that are functional and so on, they started to take us the thing more seriously and to think of the trash that is all around us.
Trained as engineers and architects, the designers are now setting their sights on building materials and the creation of environmentally responsible building practices in Palestine. Yet the ambitious designers face a number of challenges, some from unlikely places. Gath Nasser.
The biggest challenge is to find different solutions because people, like the market, has been used to certain ways of building, of constructing, of using tiles, countertops, etc. And there aren't many green alternatives. So, and as a small studio, it's not very easy to find all these sort of alternative solutions that we aspire to. So, and it's also not easy to find craftsmanship that are willing to go out of their way and try something new because they're also used to a certain way of doing things and of certain materials that they use.
With no current plans to expand into Europe or the United States, Shams Ard wants to focus on the local in order to help create a new thinking among Palestinians when it comes to design and self-sufficiency. Dana Massad.
I mean, I don't know if our goal is to change this whole industry because it's really set in its ways, and it's a challenge that all organizations, individuals that are working in the same field are facing worldwide, basically trying to change something, a paradigm that is really set in its ways. But what we're trying to do is at least find if there's a real alternative for building materials, basically, that are local, that are locally made, that empower the community, and that are sustainable, and that, you know, in the long term, sustainable. And so if we can at least show that there is, yes, an alternative, because that's always been the problem with what we've, you know, when we talk to people about, look, we're buying most of our stuff from Israel. And we talk about independence, but really we're not independent at all if we're completely dependent on Israel with this. And the building industry is a blooming industry here. And so this is one industry that needs to shift away from its dependence on Israel. And so a lot of people, their reaction is that, but there's no alternative. And so our goal is to find an alternative.
Environmentally sustainable building practice and empowerment of local communities through design has a special meaning in Palestine. Given the entrenched political contours of life here, simple initiatives which make furniture out of trash or buildings out of mud have the ability to shift social consciousness. For Shams Ard, good design extends beyond functional and attractive lines to highlight intellectual and social independence. For Monocle, in Ramallah, I'm Joseph Dana.
From the West Bank, we're heading next to Japan to attend one of the better-kept secrets of the design and craft world, namely the annual For Stockists exhibition. The event was first organised in 2004 by Tokyo-based Landscape Products to showcase the newest additions to the company's furniture lineup. Since then, the event has grown, and it now features a wide-ranging but well-curated selection of products from nearly 100 designers, artisans and shopkeepers. Every September, for 3 days, they gather at a restored former Tokyo girls' school designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. Monocle's Kenji Hall hit the aisles to see what he could find.
It can be hard to get your head around the For Stockists exhibition. At this year's 3-day event, held at Jiyugakuen Myonichikan in Tokyo, you would have found a hat maker from Kobe, a plant nursery owner from Kagoshima, a toy maker from Nagano, a blanket weaver from Mie, a small-time book publisher from Tokyo, and a furniture builder from from Hokkaido. There were also jewelry makers and aroma specialists and tea purveyors, even an organic granola guy. So what binds this motley group of shops and artisans and designers? The answer is Shinichiro Nakahara. Nakahara is founder and curator-in-chief at Landscape Products, a retail and design firm. Four Stockists reflects his refined design aesthetic and his personal mission to find, champion, and connect small artisans and designers from around the country.
For years, I've been traveling for work and meeting artisans and designers around the country. A lot of them aren't the kind that are aggressive in promoting their business. I started asking people whether they'd be interested in getting together once a year. They asked others back home, and gradually we built up to this. That's how we got together.
This year, there were 94 exhibitors. Each had a space the size of an average office worker's desk. Many brought their own props, wooden crates or shelves or racks for clothes to hang from. There were no signs, and sometimes it was hard to know where one exhibitor's space ended and the next began. Nakahara and his team vet every participant. And how do they choose? Gut instinct, according to Nakahara. Craftsmanship is the theme, but that's applied loosely.
To some extent, my staff and I go with our gut instincts. When we come across someone or a brand we want to get into the fold and want to get to know better, or someone who we think would add to and benefit from this network that we've created, we invite them to the exhibition. It's about bringing people together who find each other's craft or designs interesting and who can share that feeling. A place that makes that kind of connection possible. The scale is small. But when this is over, they can take away something that they've learned and that they can talk about with customers, factories, and artisans back home. I think a lot of people have figured out how to use Four Stockists as a meeting place and an exhibition space. They've found that it works to their advantage to be here rather than attending a larger convention at a venue like Tokyo Big Sight.
Nearly 3,000 buyers from design shops and department stores showed up. They're looking for the opposite of mass-produced goods.
So my name is Dan Inamoto. I'm from Oak Village. We are a craftsman's shop, I guess. We make wooden products, anything from tableware to children's toys to furniture and to architecture. I'm here because we want to feature some of the best Japanese crafts in our store. So we're looking for Japanese-made products that are handcrafted, ideally, and made out of natural material.
And this is for your store in Tokyo?
Exactly, yeah. We have a store in Jiyugaoka. So we're looking to showcase some of the best Japanese craftsmen's work.
And what have you found so far?
I found some good ceramic bowls and cups and things like that. There was one that was very interesting. It was ceramic, but the guy coated it with, what did he say? It was ash from some mountain in Japan, some volcano, so that it looked like iron on the outside. Very interesting work. So things like that, you know, that has a special technique involved and has some meaning behind it. It's very interesting.
Exhibitors come in the hopes of being discovered by customers in the big city. It's also a chance for them to chat up or explore collaborations with other artisans and designers. Here's Yuki Takata of Hat Shop Mature in the western city of Kobe.
We're displaying handmade straw hats stashed in boxes. Each one is soft and made to fit in a box that would normally hold a button-down shirt. We designed this hat to be easily stored. Normally, you would have to store a hat in a large round box that takes up a lot of space. I've known about this exhibition for some time. I had come in the past to find things for my own shop and had thought it was a great event. A collaborator my shop is working with approached me and asked if I'd be interested in sharing a space here. It's still early on in the event, but so far it's been well worth the time spent here.
Nakahara likes the idea of keeping the event lively and small. Nearly all of this year's exhibitors were from Japan, but Nakahara says eventually he hopes to open it up to more participants from Asia.
Normally you'd think we'd be considering expanding the event. Actually, what we're focusing on is how to make the event more fun for the people involved. It's more interesting to think how to get everyone to communicate with each other.
For many exhibitors, the highlight of the Four Stockists event came on day two, an outdoor curry party for 250 people. 9 teams from among the participants made their own original curries with organic vegetables or Kagoshima Berkshire pork and other ingredients from their hometowns. There were homemade pickles and elderflower and cinnamon-infused drinks, and plenty of craft beer and wine. An afternoon shower threatened to spoil the party, but the sky cleared just as it was growing dark, and Nakahara was there to MC and lead the toast.
Kanpai!
Kanpai!
Still to come, we'll be talking London fashion with designer Christopher Rayburn, and we'll be knitting up a storm with the Benetton team in New York. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Marching in step with our defense-themed issue, Monocle Films reported to duty at Seer Precision. Designing groundbreaking camouflage to Cooper Hewitt grads show how form and function can save lives.
We get a lot of people saying that they attribute their safety and sometimes their survival to multicam, specifically saying that in some instances we were caught in the open, we had no cover. We could see the enemy, we thought for sure they could see us, and somehow they didn't, and we were able to survive that engagement.
The Art of Getting Lost, a monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D. As London basks in its post-Olympic pride, there's a whole new set of logistics that need addressing. The Olympic Legacy Committee has a giant task at hand to knit the Stratford destination into the capital's urban fabric. But rather more urgently, there's a lot of furniture in the former Olympic village that now needs a home. And that's where the enterprising website Remains of the Games comes in. The company behind it is UK-based Rambler Furniture, and they were tasked with the fairly large mission to shift all the furniture and products used in the athlete's village. Remains of the Games is now hooking up die-hard memorabilia fans with the beds, chairs and even ice buckets used by sporting stars the world over. Our reporter, Emily Aylett, went down to the storage warehouse to hear all about it from operations controller Paul Bevan.
As a furniture hire company, people have got the idea that it's just about hiring furniture. Well, of course, it is about hiring furniture, but that's only a very, very small part of the service and the story that Rambler offer. First of all, you've got the manufacturing in the Far East. Well, it isn't easy just to get factories to produce in the scale that Rambler require. They also have to get the products made to the specifications that when somebody famous sits on them, they do not collapse. The next part, of course, is getting that product over into the areas, assembled, onto the sites in the right positions, to the right format, and it takes a huge amount of experience. Then the final part of it all is, okay, so the game's finished, take it all down and get it back to a situ whereby it comes back in good condition. And that's where Remains of the Games came into its being. You've now got this differential between Rambler being the service operation, which they're world famous for, and the disposal of the assets, and that's where Remains of the Games comes in as its own brand. Now, the brand was dreamt up really as an interesting, nice choice of words to describe what we're doing. And we created the internet site mainly so that it would work as a catalogue for the trade. What we didn't realise was how much the public would want to have something that was part of London 2012. And so what we suddenly found was that the Chesterfield chair that was sitting carefully on the edge of a lounge was suddenly demanded in Perth in Australia, along with dustbins and clocks and beanbags. And these were requests from all over the world. And then we thought, well, this is quite a surprise, because although we felt that some of these products were quite quirky, but that's not what the public say. The public say, if we want a dustbin that's been part of London 2012, and we've got the opportunity of buying a quality dustbin, a lot less money than perhaps you would find even in a discount shop, it's a double whammy. We've got quality, we've got value, we've got innovation of technology because it's the very latest specs, and then it's something that has been used at London 2012.
You touched there on some of your customers being in Australia and that the demand was more than you would ever have dreamed it. How many sales have you had? Where are your customers and who are they?
Well, let's just come out of the UK to start with. We've had a very big surge in Spain, a lot in Germany, and then America. We had a tremendous response in America. And this is mainly due to you sort of guys, you're the media, because they don't really know what's available until they read about it or hear about it. Then all of a sudden, the remains of the games is in the Washington Post, and we get thousands of people from all over the states going, wow, isn't this wonderful? How do we get the bed here? It's been as far away as Canberra and Melbourne and Sydney, and even the breakfast television shows in Australia want to pick up the story of the remains of the games. It's been a great thrill for us, a lot of fun.
We're going to go down to the warehouse in a minute to have a look at some more of the products. What's the most exciting thing that you're selling, or is there something that you're selling that's associated with someone that we would know from the Olympic Games?
This is always the question. Is it going to be the bed that so-and-so would have slept on? I'm afraid the answer's pretty standard. Unless you're in the bedroom watching, you don't know who slept on the bed. But that is part of the fun. That's part of the magic. It could be the very light that you've paid £5 for that he switched off the night before he went onto the track and broke that world record. So the magic is there, but you can't say more than that.
So, Paul, this warehouse is a real hive of activity, and you say it's not even as busy as it has been over the past few weeks. How big is this warehouse?
The one you're standing in is about 100,000 square feet.
And how many have you got of these warehouses?
We're operating at the moment between 5 and 6 of them.
Standing here, you begin to get a scale of exactly how much stock you're dealing with at the moment.
I think the word you're fishing for is awesome, and it is.
So people are fixing, maintaining furniture which has been used in the games, and you've also got lots of bagged up stock. For example, we're standing beside a huge hill of bright green bean bags. You said there were 7,000 of these going to be sold?
Yeah, just under 7. You maybe could invent that. We call it Beanbag Hill. You can go after Murray. It's going to be completely empty, bean bagless, in about 4 weeks' time. But what you're looking at the moment, which looks like a mountain, is probably only 700 or 800. So just maybe 8 to 12% of the overall.
You also mentioned that apart from selling, constructing, maintaining all of this stock, it's your job to make sure that your 6 warehouses are empty in a few weeks' time. Are you confident that's going to be an easy thing to achieve?
I'm confident, mainly because we've got a huge network of demand. We've got demand, as I've said before, globally from the end users, and then we've got equally globally from the trade and various industries who look at this sort of product and go, wow, here's an opportunity to buy the product. Despite this being used at the games, I don't really think it has such a significance to the trade, but they're looking at the product because it's great value, it's been made to a huge specification, and so it's here in a pristine condition for used product.
And once you have managed to sell everything, what's next? Are you looking forward to Rio 2016, or are you going to have a bit of a break before that?
If you're saying to me, am I practicing my Portuguese? Why, what an opportunity. Maybe I won't be invited. First of all, I've got to clear this lot.
That was Paul Bevan from Remains of the Games there with our Emily Aylett. And in one final nod to the sporting stars of the 2012 Olympics, here's College with a real hero. Cancer. That was A Real Hero by College there. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Now, Hong Kong architect Andre Fu has made a rather tidy career in a very short space of time, outfitting some of the more beautiful hotels in the Far East. He was in London last week to survey the site of his latest commission in a rather special location. He's responsible for the pool and nightclub floor of the Shangri-La Hotel in London's Shard, which will open next year. He took me through his plans here in Studio One at Midori House.
There will be a hotel at the Shard, which will actually start on level 35 and it will go up to level 52. And I'm actually working on one single floor, and that will be level 52. So it's really the pinnacle of this whole establishment.
And the hotel, it's no great secret, is the Shangri-La.
Correct.
And level 52 is going to be a gym and a swimming pool and a bar.
Correct.
So that's probably just about the most fun floor of the whole building.
Yes, because it has kind of a dual purpose. So during the day, it's mainly for fitness purpose. So there is a full-scale swimming pool alongside a gymnasium. And at night, the pool will actually become part of the bar. So the entire floor will be animated in a very different type of dynamics. Mm. It will have a different degree of energy, let's call it. And because of the way that the architecture is structured, because we have quite a small floor plate to play around with. As you know, the building actually shrinks as you go up. And because the architecture is really faceted in different angles, mm-hmm. we've designed something that is quite specific to each of the geometries. So despite the fact that the whole floor is quite holistic, in terms of the design language, each part is quite unique.
So you have the swimming pool on one side, you have the bar on the other, and then
exactly, and then the lounge. So the dynamics will kind of evolve as you move from one part to the other.
I mean, you have lived in London in the past.
Correct.
Did you grow up in London?
Well, I was born in Hong Kong, but I came to England when I was 14, and I left when I was 28. Mm. So I've been here quite a long time.
So it's fair to say you know the city quite well. But when you're standing on floor 52 of the Shard, do you get a different sense of the city when you're looking down on it?
To be honest, I would have thought that it would feel so remote from the city being so high up. But when I was physically there, I was actually really surprised. I mean, I was up there for the first time last year in about January. And actually, at the time, the curtain wires were not even up. Mm. I was actually kind of stranded, and I was just kind of standing there looking down.
Do you have
down.
That horrid urge to throw yourself off, which I always do?
Yeah,
on the top
but
of the
it's
building.
it's really exciting to see the city in that type of perspective, which is something that you don't really get previously. And because of its location, right near London Bridge, and its proximity to the River Thames, and the way kind of tails off both on the eastern side of the city and the western side of the city. It's kind of really amazing.
Well, it's scheduled to open, the Shangri-La is scheduled to open sort of middle of next year.
Correct.
So we'll definitely go up there and revisit your design, hopefully with you when it's open. But, I mean, that's really just one of many projects that you're working on at the moment.
True.
You have done very well very quickly with your architecture and interior practice,
sure.
specializing in the hospitality industry.
Correct.
How did you get into that?
It was really, it kind of really just happened. I guess I'm in the right place at the right time. I went back to Hong Kong in year 2003, and I believe it's really the time when the city is ready for a newer generation of designer, people with more of an international vision or a global vision. The design scene in Hong Kong, for example, despite the fact that it's been conceived to be very cosmopolitan, it's very forward in terms of kind of the design sense from the eastern part of the world. A lot of designers in Hong Kong, for example, they're still doing very well. They would have done very well in Hong Kong. And the only place that they would focus on is China. So Hong Kong is the benchmark. And then China is where you grow. I've taken on a slightly different perspective. I've done, I believe, reasonably well in Hong Kong, but I've used Asia as my bigger platform. So Singapore, Thailand, Hanoi, Vietnam, and obviously China, Shanghai, Beijing. So that's how I really see where my career is, fundamentally.
And obviously we don't like to reduce things to simple labels, but you have quite a sort of pan-Asian sensibility when it comes to designing these spaces, which particularly for people who are doing business and want to stay in hotels, might have to stay in a different hotel in a different country in Asia every night of the week.
Yes.
There's a sense of sort of familiarity in your designs. Do you think that's perhaps why you've been so successful?
I've talked a lot about the fact that I don't want to be conceived as someone who's style-driven. So every time if we approach a project, we follow a certain process with the client. And fundamentally, we're trying to find ways to infuse that local sensibility. And ultimately, when you're talking about hospitality design, it's the sense of comfort. And that comfort usually is, in my opinion, related to the balance in the geometry, that sense of visual balance.
We're talking balance of space as well as material.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's everything in totality. Mm. And that degree of balance will ultimately give you that sense of calm or that sense of comfort. So it's not a stylistic thing. It's more something related to emotions.
Mm, and feelings.
Yeah.
And this is something that I think too many hotels get wrong. I'm not going to mention any names at all, but I wish that more people thought about the way that people responded to environments rather than about nice furniture.
Sure. It's not about imposing a lifestyle. I mean, lifestyle really comes from within. And that's fundamentally what hospitality should be, in my opinion.
That was Hong Kong architect Andre Fu there. And from swimming pools up high to knitted garments down low, we're off to Soho, New York now, to a former mechanics garage, to be precise, where Italian brand Benetton has unearthed a new creative approach to retail. Part art gallery, part shop, Benetton's downtown outpost features the Lana Sutra, its latest tribute to love, featuring life-size sculptures from the Kama Sutra, covered in tautly woven yarn. There are also knitted design objects, from a tiny cactus to neon dolphins. And, more predictably, there's a full range of brightly coloured sweaters on offer too. Monocle's Barrett Austin headed down to meet Yu Nguyen, Benetton's creative director, and Sam Barron, the designer who directs Benetton's Fabrica Research Centre, to learn a bit more about the brand's temporary takeover of a dusty Soho garage.
I'm Sam Barron, and I'm design director at Fabrica. So we are 135 Crosby Street in New York, and it's a pop-up shop gallery for Benetton that we design. So our idea was to design a space in an old garage that is a kind of new take on of what is Benetton, so a brand based on wool and color. And the idea was to explore how young designers, artists can give a look on a brand which has a huge history in terms of communication as in terms of wool knitting product.
Tell us what's here on the design front and how this all started.
So the strategy was to rethink a bit what is the retail world. We don't want to make a new shop. We want to make a space for an experience. And the idea is that they can see products which are Benetton clothes, but at the same time they can discover an entire universe which is made of design objects designed by young people, illustration, graphic design, installation, piece of art. All is related thanks to the color sections and to the texture of the different way of knitting. So on the wall you can find some objects which are designed by Italian, British, Lebanese, and Portuguese designer. You can find also some graphic and illustration which are designed by French, Portuguese people. You can find also some flags which are made of archive pieces of Benetton. So we went basically in the catalog of pattern of Benetton and we create these new flags which are mixing pattern from the 60s with pattern from the 80s with pattern from now. And you can find also all the retail structure, the fixture that we design only for this shop. And all of this metallic structure, which are laked in different colors, are based on symbols that Benetton engineers use to program the knitting machine.
And Benetton, of course, has been a company that's never really shied away from shock. And it seems that there's something here that certainly captures your attention when you walk in. Tell us about the sculptures that have been put together by, is it Eric Ravello?
So he's a resident artist in Fabrica. He created all this Lana Sutra sculpture, which is basically Kama Sutra, which are like real-size bodies, which are showing some position of the Kama Sutra. They are all recovered by wool, and there is always two colors per couple. So for us, it was obvious that this sculpture have to be there in the fact that they are linking colors together thanks to the wool strings. And at the same time, it's also, as you say, something which is part of the Benetton DNA of having something not so shocky, because I don't think that it's really strange nowadays to see some sexual elements, but it's more about continuing this conversation that Benetton has always have ongoing with the customers. So it can be through a campaign, can be through an installation, it can be through a pullover, or it can be through a sketchbook or a collection of glass pieces. They always want to establish their own language, a communication that is working. So they propose something, they wait for a response from the customers, and it's a way of continuing. You know, it's like writing a sentence. Every word is a way to say something else, something extra to the customers.
What is the ultimate sort of takeaway from this experience? What is Benetton saying? What is Fabrica saying?
The main thing is, either you are in front of your computer and you order clothes, either you move your ass, come in the street, and it's an effort that we ask to the customers, and then you will be recompensed, because Benetton give to Fabrica the possibility to create something unique. It's a visit, it's not just a shop experience, it's a visit that the people are going to come and discover and remember. So I think it's what is also about Benetton. You create memories.
My name is Yu Gien. I'm the Chief Merchandising Officer and Global Creative Director for United Colors of Benetton. What we're attempting to do is a few things. Number one, reintroduce the Benetton brand to the U.S. consumer and the U.S. public, but at the same time, because we are in Manhattan, we will also be speaking to a much larger, more global consumer base. In speaking and reconnecting the brand with the consumer, what we're hoping to do is present the brand in a more provocative, thought-provoking manner. So yes, we are showing product, but we also want to show product in an environment that is inspiring and attempting in a way to blend commerce and art. Why does commerce has to be at the opposite end of art, and why does art has to be at the opposite end of commerce? And the two should be able to blend together nicely.
And to compare this to what Benetton has done in other retail outposts throughout the world, how is this different?
I would say that most of our stores currently are commercial stores, meaning in a place where a commercial transaction is taking place. I think what we're attempting to do here is to rethink what our retail experience should be in the future. Can you take a Benetton store? Of course, it is a commercial transactional space, but can you take it to a different level of communication so that the store actually become a communication platform as much as it is a commercial transactional space?
And in many ways, there's been sort of an ongoing struggle amongst retailers between doing e-retail and actually doing bricks and mortar. And it seems that in many ways, those who want to stick it out and keep doing bricks and mortar are doing things that are quite revolutionary. Do you think this sort of stands as an example of what retailers could do in the future? Do you think it's more about creating a truly unique experience?
I think your question is highly, highly relevant, and it is at the base, at least for me, of this project as well. There is no denying the power of digital commerce. There's no denying, let's even go beyond digital commerce into mobile commerce, TV commerce, those are different channels. Then you have traditional brick and mortar stores that has a role to play. only if you can create a difference experience that the consumer can find in a brick and mortar versus digital. If not, I can order the same thing sitting on my couch at 4 o'clock in the morning. So if you want me to come to the store, what is your store going to provide to me that is different that I cannot get from a digital experience?
That was Yu Nguyen, Benetton's creative director there with Barrett Austin in Benetton's Garage Extravaganza in Soho, New York. We're sticking with the fashion theme, though swapping knitted garments for rubberized capes. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Remade in Britain is how fashion designer Christopher Rayburn labels his clothes, reappropriating military fabrics to create garments that are functional, intelligent, and meticulously crafted. Rayburn has become the poster boy for ethical fashion. Hazel Pfeiffer caught up with him at his presentation in London Fashion Week to learn about female aviators, rubberized capes, and why Made in Britain is making a comeback.
Winner of a British Fashion Council Emerging Talent Award last year, Christopher Rayburn is still flying high. Having made his name by reappropriating military fabrics, from nylon parachutes to army fatigues, the British-born designer looked to the skies once more for his latest carefully crafted collection.
We've just shown our Spring-Summer 13 women's wear collection here at London Fashion Week. And really the early research came from sort of female aviators looking at Amelia Earhart and those real early explorers, you know, when looking in the 1920s, 30s, when that sort of spirit of adventure was really prevalent, really important.
Can you tell me about the 1950s escape maps?
Yeah, each season we do a different remade story, and by that I mean it's part of our collection where we're deconstructing and reworking original military garments or different items. And this season we've been able to access these really, really beautiful 1950s silk escape maps, and they're incredibly high quality. We've been able to get them from all different nations, everywhere from Russia to Vietnam to Scandinavia. And actually, we've been asked a lot, you know, what were they even for and why were they printed onto silk? And we've done quite a lot of research, and pilots in the 1950s, 60s, and even actually all the way up to today, they're printed on fabric rather than paper because paper could perish if it was wet and, you know, all of a sudden you'd end up with this sort of sodden mess. Yeah, we've been really proud of the way that we've been able to take this original item and then rework them into dresses, play suit, and then different jackets in the collection.
Finding the right material is an intrinsic part of creating each collection.
The sourcing of the original materials really is a lot about archaeology, and it's a little bit about getting out and sourcing everywhere from Ministry of Defence contracts, and we source things in warehouses in deepest, darkest Basildon, and then concepts that I've been able to build up over the years. But then kind of even all the way down to eBay, weirdly, where again, you find some interesting things, and it might be that you only find one to begin with, but then the kind of search begins to see if you can find 20, 30, enough to do production on a significant amount of remade pieces.
And you source internationally as well?
We've sourced military fabrics from a great deal of different places, all about the quality of the original item for me. So we've taken Swedish, really beautiful Melton jackets. We've taken American items, quilted liners. We've taken Chinese rubberized cotton capes, and all been deconstructed and sort of reworked into different garments. So it's a lot about the original fabric and the original qualities of the fabric. And that's often what helps to dictate the new product that we're developing as well.
For Christopher, keeping close to Britain is an essential part of the business. Production is split between his studio in East London other factories around the UK, and some more recently in Eastern Europe. But by staying mostly local, the label is helping to draw attention back to British manufacturing.
What's been really encouraging is that my own sort of research and constant exploration, along with the team, you know, our product developers, we keep on sort of covering amazing UK manufacturing. And I've been to visit factories in Manchester that are still doing 90,000 garments a year, you know, and they're producing for Gives and Hawks, for Marks and Spencer, for Topshop, for all of these other guys. And, you know, I do think that there's been certainly a resurgence in UK manufacturing, and I think that there seems to be a lot more focus and a lot more press, in fact, on Made in England and why potentially it's very useful sort of nationally. And so it does seem bit by bit that certainly the elements that maybe have gone abroad, some is coming back, I think.
It's also an exciting time for menswear with the new London Fashion Week for menswear in June. What was it like being a part of that?
Yeah, I mean, the menswear collection, so London collections back in June, which now seems many, many years ago, was, I think, absolutely fantastic for British menswear, because it's actually really put us on the map in terms of the way that press, the way that buyers, etc., actually access that collection. And, you know, to be having that platform now twice a year when it actually makes sense, you know, before Pitti, before Milan, after New York, etc., it's brilliant. And on a business level, I'm very proud that we've grown our wholesale this season really quite significantly off the back of that show.
Christopher Rayburn is, above all, a storyteller. A sense of history and hours of meticulous research are apparent in every detail of his work. Even the show's bespoke soundtrack playfully incorporated the sounds of the clothing with diving aeroplanes, helping to bring the collection to life.
For me, it's just such an important part of the brand, really, as well, and it's sort of quite a almost a sort of holistic approach to design in general, because it's not just about that sort of look on the model, you know, it's that whole experience. And I really enjoy the fact that people come away not just with the sort of view on the collection, but hopefully they'll have actually felt something emotionally, etc. I think there's so much fun you can have really in fashion. It doesn't just have to be about, you know, does that model look good or not? It's so much more than that.
That was our reporter Hazel Pfeiffer there with Christopher Rayburn at his Knockout London Fashion Week show. And that brings us to the end of this week's episode of Section D. London Fashion Week might have ended, but the annual Design Festival has now descended in its place. And for next week's show, we'll be bringing you as many highlights as we can cram into 1 hour. So be sure to tune in then. Today's show was produced by Gillian Tobias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Playing you out in honour of London's festival season, here's a song from the brilliant new album of an institutional homegrown band. This is Saint Etienne with Heading to the Fair. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.